by educating yourself on the signs and symptoms of gaming disorder. And then if you yourself as a video game player notice an increasing amount of time spent playing and are questioning whether or not you're playing problematically, then you can ask yourself, what is your motivation behind the gameplay?
All across the world, we have found ways to cut loose after a long day or to find activities to relieve a little bit of stress from the daily activities. For many of us, that includes video games, whether it's on your mobile phone or your Xbox or PlayStation or whatever video game server you're looking for. But did you know that nearly 10% of people in the United States suffer from video game addiction? What does that look like? What are some of the characteristics of people that have gone beyond normal playing to being a full-blown addiction? Today we're joined by Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Morel on Tartan Talks to discuss this addiction and what we're doing about it. How can we tell some of the signs of an individual with an addiction? And how can we prevent a hobby such as video games from becoming something dangerous? Thank you for joining us today on Tartan Talks. I'm Christopher LaFuria, and welcome to Season 3 of Tartan Talks. This is Tartan Talks, a podcast from Edinburgh University. I'm your host, Christopher LaFuria. Each month, we'll take a look at individuals who make Edinburgh an exciting, diverse, and profound place to discover your passions. All right, thank you so much for joining us today for Tartan Talks. We have a special guest today who's going to be talking about an important trend. We're going to talk about video games. We're going to talk about internet usage. And it's very important and kind of a topic that doesn't really get as much attention as you'll see it probably deserves. So today we have Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Morel. She is an assistant professor in Edinburgh University's social work department, and she's also a licensed clinical social worker. So Dr. Diaz-Morel, thank you so much for joining us today on Tartan Talks.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
All right. I think we have a great chat lined up for you today. We're going to be talking about video games. We're going to be talking about internet usage. But before we get started, if you could talk a little bit about your research and your background as a social worker. You do a lot of work with Latinx culture, with non-Latinx Black youth, with adolescents, and everything from e-cigarettes to video games to internet usage. So if you could talk a little bit about your background before we get started.
Absolutely. So as you shared, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I'm also a master certified addiction professional. And essentially what all of these credentials mean is that I've been working in the field for a long time. And most of my field work, my clinical work, centered around working with adolescents and young adults that were experiencing some sort of addiction, either a substance use disorder or a behavioral addiction or a combination of both. And sometimes it was more in the residential zone where they were needing treatment that was more intensive. And sometimes it was outpatient, a little bit more preventative. So through my clinical work, I really found the interest for my research. And that was looking at behavioral addictions and at what point a behavior that can be a form of entertainment and has plenty of pro-social benefits can become potentially problematic. And that's where my interest in going from addictions to just looking at problematic behaviors really grew from into my clinical work.
And you said you work a lot with adolescents. So why do you think that area, that demographic really stuck with you?
So I first started doing this work in 2013 is when I really hit the ground running. And I think that with adolescents, it's such an important developmental stage for us as humans. We are leaving childhood behind, but yet still in it. And now emerging as young adults, there's a lot of responsibilities, a lot of characteristics, and a lot of social aspects that come into the human development stage for adolescents and young adults. And so including technology usage at that age has really changed some of the developmental perspectives that we have when working with adolescents. There is a lot more of a demand for adolescents to engage with one another through social media, the way in which they interact and communicate with one another has changed vastly because of technology. And so, you know, with my research, it really encompasses technology use in general with this population and the good, the not so good that that is involved with technology use in adolescence.
So that's pretty interesting that you talk about technology, because when you look at adolescent issues, whether it's behavioral or substance abuse, we have the traditional topics that I think are very much highlighted, such as youth smoking, youth drinking. And when it comes to behavioral, we talk a lot about bullying. And definitely with the turn of the 21st century, we started to get into social media and its impact on youth, video games, as far as a behavior is concerned. So if you see weapons or bad behavior on video games, we measure how much that has an impact. But a lot of your research and a lot of what we want to chat about today is how technology, how the internet and video games, how that is a form of addiction that you might not recognize unless you see the signs. Recently, video game addiction, correct me if I'm wrong, has been added to the DSM-5, the manual for mental disorders. And, you know, it's a very addictive behavior. You see a lot of behaviors when it comes to technology and video games, similar to, you know, whether it's an addiction to smoking. You see a lot of the mood modification and withdrawal and conflict. So talk about your research with technology as an addiction and what kind of you have found with your research and how that's prevalent today.
Sure, absolutely. So in the DSM-5, they included a diagnosis called internet gaming disorder. And this was included in the 2013 publication. So it's been quite some time since that came out. And it actually is not in the formal part of the DSM-5, which is the portion where you would, as a practitioner, bill and use the criteria to formulate a diagnosis, such as major depressive disorder. It's actually in a section called Section 3 of the DSM-5, which is a section where diagnostic considerations warranting further study was included. So essentially the American Psychiatric Association, who are in charge of developing and publishing the DSM-5 that is used by practitioners all over North America and some other countries, but mainly in North America, included this section due to so many diagnoses that really needed additional study in the US. Meanwhile, in other countries, such as in China, in Australia, in South Korea, in the Netherlands, we have a plethora of research that has been done over several decades on gaming disorder in particular. And they have so much support and evidence for it that these countries have federal funding for treatment and prevention efforts for gaming disorder. So if someone were to come to a federally funded mental health clinic in, let's say, South Korea, and they have symptoms of gaming disorder and are diagnosed with gaming disorder, they have federal funding to pay for treatment. And they also have nationwide prevention efforts where individuals go around to public schools, for example, during middle school age, and target youth to explain to them the dangers of gaming disorder, how to prevent it, finding a balance between playing games and other parts of their social emotional development. So spending time face-to-face with friends, spending time in sports, spending time with family, and of course, engaging in academic schoolwork. So here in the US, we've had an understanding of gaming disorder as well, but most of the research has been a small sample size. It hasn't been a nationally representative sample that really we can justify the inclusion of internet gaming disorder as a billable diagnosis. But since 2013, there has been a lot of research that has come out to support gaming disorder with samples that include the US and all varying ages. So that's really something that we're hoping in the next rendition of the DSM, they will have gaming disorder. The criteria will be slightly adjusted and it'll be billable. And I'm part of a working group that is establishing that as well. So we're hoping for the next rendition it will be included. But there is another diagnostic book called the International Classification of Diseases that's created by the World Health Organization. Their new edition is going into effect January of 2022, and they did include gaming disorder as a billable diagnosis.
Oh, wow.
So now here in the US, we use ICD-11 codes, which is the version coming out. So as a clinician, as a licensed clinical social worker, I can now include that when I'm billing insurances, and they will have the data to see that this is something that individuals are experiencing so that they can get coverage for it.
Interesting. So as you say, it's not necessarily a new disorder, but I think a lot of the, whether it's a misconception or a lack of information that's spread nationwide, we see a lot of the stereotypes of gaming. So so-and-so plays a lot of games online, or you'll see in a sitcom how a mother and fathers view their kid as playing too many video games, or they need to get outside or things like that. And that's kind of been the stereotype. How would you differentiate between somebody that just plays a lot of video games? When does it become an actual disorder, or when does it actually become a behavioral issue that really needs to be addressed?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's my most commonly asked question, right? Individuals contact me to ask about this question. When I started doing a lot of research in this field and was still doing clinical work at the time, I was a member of a consortium of a lot of agencies that we would meet on a quarterly basis. And I presented to them some of my research and shared, do any of you see problematic technology usage with the children and families that you service throughout? At this time, it was in South Florida. And many of them said that they were starting to see some, but it was still up and coming. And the discussion went from what quantifies something as a problematic behavior versus a regular behavior, right? How do we really know? The answer isn't very simple, right? We need, of course, a formal diagnosis in order to determine if something is problematic. And yeah, I mentioned before, but I always like to say that video games within themselves are not something that's bad, right? Video games are a form of entertainment. Personally, you know, just to self-disclose, I play video games. I identify as a gamer. And so there are a lot of pro-social benefits also that come with gaming. There are studies that have shown surgeons, when they're playing certain games before going into surgery, it increases their hand-eye coordination. Of course, we have esports leagues now that also are receiving scholarships to go to universities and also to engage in being esports athletes. So there's a number of benefits when it comes to playing video games. But just like any other behavior, right, like an eating disorder or alcohol use, there is a point where it can become problematic in someone's life. So where do we draw that line in the sand? And so I think that instead of thinking of it as a line in the sand, we should start thinking of it as some warning signs when, you know, if it's smooth sailing and the lake is flat, when it starts getting choppy, then that's when it might not be a good idea to take the boat out. Right, the same kind of analogy for problematic video gaming. So the top warning signs are if an individual's family or loved ones see that person who has gaming disorder, their mood has changed significantly. They've lost interest in all other hobbies that they might have had before, and gaming becomes the primary use of their time. And also, if they are experiencing consequences from their video game playing. And these consequences can look like lack of sleep. It can look like getting in trouble at work because of calling out sick too frequently to play a game. And it can look like failing grades at school, right? Spending your time playing instead of studying or completing an assignment or going to class. And those are some of the most common signs that you can see externally when someone might be crossing into a more problematic area.
Yeah, and you also have those withdrawal symptoms too. So if you, whether you go on a family vacation or if you spend a lot of time like in academics, if you see that sense of withdrawal too, it's kind of like a a chain smoker that had quit smoking for a little while, you have that withdrawal symptoms too. So what are some ways that you can prevent these sort of issues? Because like you said, we have a esports program here at Edinburgh University, and we have a lot of our student athletes that go to play for team building exercises. And there are a lot of people that play, they rack up the hours on their video game systems, but it gets to the point where they don't have the mood modification, they don't have the withdrawal symptoms, and their lives are relatively conflict-free relative to the gaming. Mm-hmm. So at what level do you notice, or how can you prevent that sort of addiction so that you can stop it from becoming a behavioral issue?
I think some of the biggest ways to prevent gaming disorder are by having a conversation, by educating yourself on the signs and symptoms of gaming disorder. And then if you yourself as a video game player notice an increasing amount of time spent playing and are questioning whether or not you're playing problematically, then you can ask yourself, what is your motivation behind the gameplay? Is it to get my skills up so that I can be a better competitive player? Is it to relieve some stress from a busy day? Is it to enjoy the cutscenes in a new RPG because it's very fun and movie-like? Or is it to escape negative, unwanted feelings? Is it to avoid conversations or other people? Is it to withdraw from day-to-day activities and immerse yourself 100% fully into this online world?
So that's interesting. You brought up using a video game to kind of escape. I feel like all sorts of entertainment can be a not necessarily a cure, but a way for you to take your mind off things. So if you have a very stressful day at work, you come home and you cook and you put some music on. Or if you get into an argument at work and you're really feeling down, you put on a video game to kind of take your mind off of it. How does it go from just something that can take your mind off of something to an addiction where it becomes dangerous? Because we all either play video games or, you know, go for a run or have some sort of behavior to take our minds off of things. How do you recognize, or how does it become problematic? Right. What signs do you look for?
Right. So when it comes to excessive usage, if your main focal point is using a video game to cope with daily life stressors, and we don't have any other coping mechanisms, that can potentially lead to something becoming problematic. Because you just mentioned several ways to deal with the end of a stressful day, or also several ways just to live your life, right? You can come home and cook a meal, put on some music, you can play a video game, you can go for a run, you can spend some time outdoors in nature, you can read a book. There's just a number of ways to kind of cope with stress and also to enjoy the many activities that we can do in our lives and to have a variety of them. So when we go from having, again, this balance of a couple of different ways to cope or a couple of different activities to engage in that increase our serotonin levels, right, that give us that happiness feeling in our brain, and we are only using one source, which would be the video game playing, then that's when it can potentially become problematic, right? So not being aware of that. And finding alternative ways to relax.
That's interesting. So if maybe you're at work, you're at school, and all you can think about is taking your minds off of things by playing that video game, or you don't have other options, so like you don't choose music or reading, it's all about video games. That's kind of where that starts, where that addictive behavior can begin, correct?
Yeah. It certainly can. And there's a lot of research about escapism. One of the criteria currently in the DSM-5 for internet gaming disorder is escapism, circles around escapism with the preoccupation. And, you know, I think it really varies from each individual case. The clients that I've seen, some of them have experiences of escapism, but many of them are also utilizing video games as a form of maladaptive coping strategies to deal with some stressor or traumatic event that has occurred in their life, and this is what feels good, which kind of aligns with some of the other behavioral addictions that we've seen with eating disorder, for example, right? We eat excessively if they were overeating because it feels good. So it's sure. The same kind of response in our body and our brain.
Interesting. So earlier you mentioned that you do a lot of work with adolescents and you really get into the development of the minds and the bodies. And it's very important, I would think, to get a handle on video game playing before it becomes an addiction. Now, would you see with adolescents, would you say the video game addiction, the addiction to technology, would you say it's more common with that age group, or do you think it's just more impactful with that age group? So there's a lot of college students that stay up late playing video games, and maybe into adulthood, there are gamers that may have developed an issue. What about the adolescent age do you think is something that we should, focus on? Is it the prevalence or is it the depth of the issue that could arise?
Right. I think there's a lot of concern with children and adolescents because of the developmental stage that they're in, their growth, and how a problematic behavior can impact that, especially for healthy brain and body development, right? We know lack of sleep can significantly impact that as well. So that's where most of the concern lies. But when we look at the statistics, the average age of a gamer is actually 32 years old. And so I think that we should look beyond just adolescents and young adults and consider anyone really can experience problematic video game disorder. I've had a number of clients lately who are 65 and over that are also experiencing problematic gaming with the convergence of gambling because they're playing mobile phone games that are free to play. But of course, a lot of free to play games tend to incentivize you to purchase loot boxes, which have gambling like mechanics. And they are continuously purchasing items to keep playing, but the currency makes it seem as if the monetary value is not as much as the virtual value. So they end up spending more. And this is a very common practice in a lot of video game companies now that utilize free-to-play games. Like we see this mechanic in Fortnite as well. So if we think of children in particular who might already be playing, let's say Fortnite, for example, with their friends after school, completely common, right? Sometimes you used to go to the park and meet up with your friends after school or go ride your bikes. Well, now we're going to go meet up, on our server through Fortnite and play for an hour or two before having to do homework or after homework. And this is now the new third place for these youth. So thinking about how they're using the game and if they have it connected to their parents' accounts, for example, and the loot boxes are there looking shiny and they need it in order to either customize their skins or advance in the game, then they're going to probably be more susceptible to these mechanics that are utilized in games that also mimic gambling mechanics. So that's, I think, one of the most concerning areas for parents is not just the amount of time, but also money that's being spent in the game.
Now, do you think the individuals, whether they are adolescents or adults, do you think that the video game itself, that they are becoming addicted to because of its own individual properties? Or do you think that these individuals are predisposed to an addictive behavior and that this is the vehicle that satiates that? So is it the video game itself that they're getting addicted to, or is it that they need something to fill an already addiction, whether it is gambling or whether it's alcohol and cigarettes or whether it's the video game?
Right. That's a good question. So causality, right? What is the cause essentially of this problematic behavior? Or this excessive video gaming? And the short answer is combination of many things, right? There really is no one factor that we can pinpoint and say, this is what's going to lead to this to an addictive behavior, to something that is more than problematic, to a gaming disorder. There's a lot of research too, that looks at particular genres. So in the research world of gaming disorder and video games, about 10 years ago, up until most recently, a lot of games have examined players and MMORPGs, right? So massive multiplayer online role-playing games. And for those who don't know, these are the kind of games that really have no end, and they're also very social. So you join this team, which is a guild, in an effort to beat a major boss, right? Or to focus on a singular task that cannot be done alone. And I often, when working with clients or talking about this topic, liken that to working in any job where you have group projects, right? You have to collaborate with others at work. We might have our own individual tasks, but sometimes we have group tasks that need to be completed with others. So through an MMORPG, individuals can learn these skills that can then be applied to physical world jobs where they are now collaborating better, they're communicating more effectively because they had to learn to do so inside of this MMORPG where they were sometimes in groups of 100, 200 people in order to achieve a shared goal. So these are some of the good skills, but at the same time, MMORPGs are the top genre of video game that have been deemed as problematic and potentially addictive.
Interesting.
To a lot of researchers saying, oh, MMORPGs, no, that's the genre that's going to, if any adolescents in particular play that genre, it's going to lead to an addictive behavior. And to that, you know, I say I don't think that's necessarily true. I have seen plenty of individuals play MMORPGs non-problematically. I've had some clients that play MMORPGs that meet criteria for gaming disorder, but I have plenty of clients who play other genres of video games and also meet criteria for gaming disorder. Sometimes even the type of games that someone thinks would not lead to gaming disorder, like Animal Crossing.
Yeah, and then there's the mobile phone games like Candy Crush or Angry Birds that, right. that they have nothing to do with teamwork. It's just, like you said, it's almost like a form of gambling too. So there is that addictive element to it as well. Mm-hmm. So in your research, is there a certain background of an individual where you see this more prevalent, whether it's lower to middle or higher socioeconomic status? Is there a, you know, a race or gender issue to it? Where are you seeing the cases of video game addiction being the highest in your own experience?
So some of the research as far as prevalence rates for gaming disorder show that the highest concentration of prevalence with nationally representative samples are in Asian countries. So that's in China, in South Korea, we see the highest prevalence rates, followed by Hungary and Australia. And then in the US, it's anywhere between 7 to 14% of the individuals who play video games show symptoms of gaming disorder as far as prevalence is concerned. But some of this data is a bit older. It's pre-COVID. And, you know, during the first year of COVID in 2020, around March, there was a huge surge reported by the Entertainment Software Association, ESA, and they really are an association that's in charge of keeping track of the gaming statistics. And they reported a huge increase in individuals who were playing video games. Now, of course, this was seems to be a direct response to being home, being in quarantine, having the time to do so. As we know, many people lost their jobs or were furloughed. And so we saw this huge increase in video game playing. And many of the increase, many of the individuals who were playing might have been those who had a game and weren't able to play because of other life responsibilities. But many of them also were individuals who were playing because of negative or unwanted feelings that they were having due to the pandemic, mm-hmm. You know, either loss of employment or being unable to celebrate with loved ones, with having a party, these kind of gatherings. And I got a huge increase of individuals reaching out to me about May, June of 2020 because of they were concerned with their own behavior or the behavior of a loved one who was excessively playing video games. And after uncovering it, most of the cases were of people who were very sad, right? They were utilizing video games to avoid this feeling of sadness because they couldn't connect with their loved ones in a regular face-to-face setting, and now had gone into an area of their lives where they preferred to just interact online and weren't sure if going out was safe or not. And so a lot of mixed feelings, a lot of uncertainty leading to an increase in video game playing amongst the general population with all age groups as a result of the pandemic.
Interesting. So with that said, I know you are a self-proclaimed gamer. You do a lot of online education. So you are, for all intents and purposes, behind a screen a lot for your job and for your life. How do you personally, I mean, I know you have a background in as a licensed clinical social worker, so you know how to predict a lot of these behaviors, but how do you personally separate yourself from the video game to the point where you know it's not becoming an addiction? Because like you said, their video games are, they can be great. They can be a great tool for decision-making, for hand-eye coordination, for teamwork. You know, there are a lot of people putting in miles on their video game device. So how do you personally separate yourself from that? Or how do you develop a personal plan so that it doesn't become full-blown addiction?
Right. Yeah, good question. Well, first, I'd just like to say that you use the term screen, being behind a screen. So screen time is also a way to kind of encompass everything we've been talking about today, right? Because we've been focusing mainly on video games. But if we also look at just internet usage or screen time in general, there is a lot of research on screen time usage with children and the concerns for that. And lately, there's been a shift in perspective from viewing screen time as something that is potentially harmful if it's excessively utilized with young children to viewing the type of screen time as more important for appropriate development and age. So for example, when it comes to young children who are infants, the American Pediatric Association recommends no more than 2 hours of screen time. Well, that recommendation has been changed to no more than 2 hours of entertainment screen time, because of course, children are now attending school virtually or have done so in the past. And even if they're face-to-face, they have homework that is often virtual, placing them in front of a screen. They have their devices and their tablets that they might be utilizing for entertainment as well. So that has changed with the times. And there also used to be a recommendation of no screen time for infants 0 to 2, but that's also changed for the content of the screen time. The recommendation is now that no screen time unless the infants are communicating with caregivers who they don't have the ability to see in person. So for example, grandparents who perhaps aren't able to see the infant for whatever reason can connect via FaceTime, right, via video chat. And as long as the interaction is engaging for the infant, so they're smiling, they're responding, they're hearing, you can tell that they're not just staring at the screen, but they are hearing their grandparents' voices, for example, or their other caregivers' voices, then that is okay now by the American Pediatric Association, because we have research to support that that's helpful for the infant's development. So, you know, research is constantly changing and evolving. And considering the screen time that we use, right, I use the same principles when it comes with my work for content. So am I watching content that is something that's going to enhance my life, right? And what does that mean, enhance my life? Is it going to make me think about something? Is it going to be a brain break and I'm just watching some really cute puppy videos online? Or is it something that is a puzzle, inquisitive? Is it building brain elasticity? Or is it work that also can do that? So finding different ways to make the content fit within different aspects of your life is a good way to find a balance. And that's what I do. I kind of think of it like a diet, right? It's just a digital diet. So every once in a while, I'm going to have some French fries and a burger, but I should probably balance that out later on with some veggies and lean protein for my next meal. Same kind of perspective when I'm working all day, teaching online classes, and then playing my video games. How is the content impacting me? And of course, just being cognizant of the amount of time in front of the screen as well.
So that seems kind of like an analogy, like relating video game usage to a diet. But if you think about all the addictive behaviors, well, not all of them, but a lot of them, there's nothing wrong with having a glass of wine. But when it becomes addictive, that's when you have your problem. So it's almost like looking at technology and video games in the same lens as you would a lot of the other addictive behaviors too. So you can see a lot of the same behaviors, you can see a lot of the same withdrawal. So you have to almost be metacognizant of what you're doing. You have to be thinking about what you're thinking about, whether it comes to setting a diet for eating or whether it's, like you said, a digital diet too. So it takes a little bit of grunt work ahead of time to know that you are, you know, feeding your brain healthy messages and healthy images, but also like, you know, you're spending your time appropriately. And you can sneak in, you know, a little puppy dog video here and there, just like you would a candy bar every now and then. But, you know, when it becomes too much or when it overtakes your beneficial digital usage, that's when it really becomes an issue.
Right. Absolutely. I think one of the easy ways to think about it, and something that I often tell individuals who are striving for this balance, is compare it to mindful, your mind is full, or mindfulness, right? So is your mind full, or are you being mindful of what the content is that you are viewing, of the time that you're spending on the screen, and how is it servicing you, right? What is the intention that you have when you pick up your controller and you're going to play video games today? Is the intention to increase your skills, to pass your high score, to level up? Are you going to grind and get some materials so you can get better gear? What is the intention behind picking up that controller? What is the intention behind the actions that you're engaging in today? And having that intention set, even if it's right there in the moment before you start playing, can really help to prevent your mind from being mindful and practicing some mindfulness while playing.
I think a lot of content creators these days are starting to pick that up. They're starting to realize that we've spent decades negative when it comes to technology, like you shouldn't be watching that garbage or video games are bad. But I think a lot of content creators are kind of turning the page on that, and they are taking it from a more positive approach. You know, you see a lot of cooking shows that are appeasing younger audiences as well as adults. You see a lot of children's content that adults enjoy as well, so they can, you know, watch it with their children, and they're learning as well as being entertained too. So where do you think the content creators stand in this battle for addiction? Do you think that we are seeing a lot more focus on creating content that can create the mindfulness and not just the mindful? Or do you think we still have a long way to go on that? And that goes for YouTube content, video games, and all sorts of screen time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's probably a bit of a combination of the two, but there, I agree, there is a bit of a shift that we're seeing now with content creators. And most recently, I had an opportunity to work with a team of UX designers for my nonprofit organization, Reboot and Recover. And we were discussing in their formal college education what kind of information they received for learning to create content or being web developers. Many of them were web developers and engineers, computer engineers. And what they shared with me was quite interesting. I actually, one of the board members on Reboot and Recover is also a computer engineer. So we have a lot of conversations about this. But there's no sense of how to ethically create content that will be more socially conscious or beneficial. Most of them didn't receive that in their formal education or training. Later on, when they're employed as UX writers, and what they're doing now is, of course, developing the user experience by creating content that is made to be engaging, many of them shared with me that the large companies they worked for, their mission was stated as developing content so that the user never puts their phone down.
Wow.
From the moment they wake up until they shut their eyes, that they're on our website, that they're viewing our product, that they're consuming our content. And that for me was a big wake-up call, and also got me very excited that they wanted to work with Rebooter Recover to develop content, and also took it upon themselves to create more socially conscious awareness of problematic technology usage and when content can become mindful, practicing this mindfulness. So I know that at least from that cohort, there are some UX writers who went off and are creating content that is not designed to keep someone constantly coming back in a rather addictive manner. And I know that there are some that are working for organizations that do that. And when it comes to video games, it's similar as well with the content that's created for the games. And I think it comes down to the culture of that gaming company, where some of them are constantly trying to create video games that are free to play and that have loot boxes and that have these, you know, fast food, French fry content that you're downloading. But then they'll also put in maybe some content that is going to be more entertaining and engaging or thought provoking. So I hope that we'll have more options as time continues and as we have more conversations about this and create more of an awareness so that the consumers of the content, that's us, have a choice on whether we'd like to have a salad or a burger that day.
Yeah, definitely. So you talked a little bit about Reboot and Recover, which is the nonprofit that you run, which focuses on some of the topics that we talked about today. Tell us a little bit about what you do and what's the mission of that organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. So Reboot and Recover is a nonprofit organization, a 501c3 that I founded in 2013. And our mission is to provide solutions for a balanced living in a technology-driven world. And what we've been doing is providing prevention, education, intervention, and research for a variety of problematic technology usages. The main focus is on problematic video gaming or gaming disorder, on problematic internet usage, and problematic social media usage. And through the organization, we've conducted research, gone to many, many health fairs in high schools, in middle schools, at colleges, and provided information on ways to reduce screen time. We have a couple of initiatives that we've engaged in, including a pledge to reduce screen time. And there is a movie, a documentary called Social Animals that was developed in California that we also partnered with them, Conscious Mind Studios, to support their movie. And they in turn supported Reboot and Recover and spread the information that we provide to individuals online on how to reduce screen time. And we have a number of other partnerships as well. There is a telehealth organization that provides treatment and specializes in treating those with gaming disorder or problematic gaming and gambling disorder. And Reboot and Recover has partnered with them to expand the reach that we have for those who are seeking treatment, and also to help parents and loved ones of those who are concerned with this potentially problematic behavior or just want to learn more about it. And we're working with two video game companies that want to create more socially conscious content and also have a relationship with a health provider that can treat any of their clients, but also their employees, because the video game industry, there is often a phenomenon called crunch, where the video game creators, developers, spend a long period of time developing the video game or coding or, you know, testing it, beta testing it. And that can have a significant impact on their mental health as well. And so we're consulted to provide them with services to help find their balance between working, especially working on a project they love, because many of them are gamers themselves, so they have a passion for it. And that can lead sometimes to the overwork or the crunch that they experience.
Definitely. And we will include a link to your organization in the notes too. So if you want to check out Reboot and Recover, we'll have all that information for you as well. The last thing I wanted to talk about today before we wrap up, and whenever I'm reading an academic research, it's one of my favorite parts. It's the where do we go from here? What future research is needed? It's almost like a to be continued. So let's look at to see what's happening next. In your opinion or in your experience, what's next for research when it comes to video game addiction? What do we need to know, and where do you see that research going?
So there's a lot that we need to know, but I think some of the more important things to know, especially to help clinicians who are interested in treating this or who work with, you know, adolescents and young adults or adults who are experiencing gaming disorder, is what is the most effective treatments for gaming disorder? And also, what are some of the potential predictive variables, right? What do we know is something that might lead to problematic video gaming or to gaming disorder with a particular population or just with an individual? Is there some kind of a predisposition that can help us to identify if someone's more at risk than someone else? And I think having a general sense of that with some evidence behind it would be extremely helpful for not just clinicians or practitioners who are treating this when it gets to the point of something more problematic or disordered, but it'll also be helpful because that can translate to educators knowing about it who are in primary, secondary, you know, high school, and those who are teaching in academia or in higher ed as well. They now are aware of some of the warning signs and can potentially give some information on prevention efforts or even just have the conversation with a student or their family about, have you considered the amount of content that you're viewing online, or have you considered, finding a balance between your schoolwork and entertainment and other life activities would look like. So having more research, more evidence that can support who we can target for that and what we can look for as a community, as clinicians, as educators, as those who care about someone who might be experiencing these symptoms, is really important to move this forward and to create more of an awareness.
Very interesting. So it looks like we have a lot of homework on our plate. We have a lot we need to know, but it's rather encouraging to know that there are professionals taking technology and video game addiction not only seriously, but they're really trying to address the root of it and try to find how we can help more people and overcome a lot of their issues. So Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Murrell, thank you so much for joining us today on Tartan Talks. Very fascinating stuff. And I'm really interested to see what happens next with this field. So thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your expertise.
Yes, thank you for having me.